Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to State of the Empire, Consequence of Sound, Star Wars Speculation Podcast, where we look for news in Alderaan places. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hey, I'm Doug.
And I'm Matt.
Now, you might have noticed in that little intro there, that, well, there was a couple things different. You heard Consequence of Sound thrown around quite a bit. That's because with this episode, we are officially transitioning from State of the Empire being a signature Nerdy Show Network program to being a signature program of Consequence of Sound's newly christened podcast network. And Consequence has been sort of co-producing, co-featuring State of the Empire for like over a year at this point. I've worked for Consequence of Sound, as most folks who've been listening to us through Nerdy Show probably know. But now, not only do I run the Nerdy Show Network, I also run the Consequence Podcast Network. As of this episode's release, that big public announcement hasn't exactly happened yet, but along with this show and the other currently running show on the Consequence Podcast Network, the Stephen King show, The Losers Club, we've both been pretty candid about what's going on. Now that we kind of have the ins and outs of it, the network will officially debut later this month in January 2018, and there'll be a lot of other new programs coming along, some of which will involve other faces from Nerdy Show, and we're still recording in the Nerdy Show studio with Nerdy Show personnel, and we're still very much tethered to the heart and soul of Nerdy Show, but as far as State of the Empire and the super specific Star Wars discussion that it embodies, that's a lot more in line with the kind of programming that Consequence is going to be putting out. So that's where we ended up. It seemed like it made the most sense. All of our Star Wars coverage that we've done over the years, like going to Star Wars Celebration and all that, that's all been via Consequence of Sound credentials. So it's really just a natural progression of things. Meanwhile, Nerdy Show is still going to be putting out the same cornucopia of nerdy awesomeness that you know and love. And we're actually kind of doubling down our efforts on our audio drama shows in the coming year. So check out the Consequence Podcast Network. And if you're from the Consequence side of things, check out the Nerdy Show Network. Two great tastes that taste great together.
Sort of an alliance of rebels, if you will. Yeah. Like a rebel alliance.
I like it. I like the way you think, Matt. This episode is dedicated almost exclusively, with a couple exceptions, to the forthcoming Han Solo solo film, Solo, which comes out, allegedly, May 25th. We've got the first waves of some serious new information coming out of there, some toy leaks that are providing us with some further perspective on the characters and the story, so we're very excited to dig into that, speculate on what's to come, and also we've got some talk about comic books and some weird theme park stuff to discuss. Now, before we get started, one real quick thing. There are the blast doors. Those are spoiler-proof blast doors, and when we open them, we're going to talk about spoilers. But for most of the show, it's completely what we believe to be spoiler-free. We're going to talk about some things in regards to Solo, but it's all going to be really surface-level speculation, nothing more than you couldn't get from walking down an aisle in Target and figuring out for yourself. So it's all going to be light stuff, but once we open the blast doors, then there will be the spoilers. But in the meantime, fear not.
I just want to point out that, like, Qui-Gon's death could have been in front of the blast doors.
Hey, Matt, let's not invalidate the power of the blast doors here. I mean, we all know that the track on the soundtrack, Qui-Gon's Noble End, was absolutely, like, one of the dumbest things to ever happen in Star Wars history in terms of play.
And only to be followed up by the Jango Fett toy that's head fell off.
Yes.
Because that was released before the movie, too.
Very dumb things.
Where does the Chewbacca spiral notebook fit into all that?
So that's what it is. It's as the blast doors are closing, Qui-Gon Jinn, Jango Fett, and sad Chewbacca jumped through the blast doors as they were closing.
Sure. But look, for you folks out there who really want to dodge all the spoilers, we think we have your back, all right? We'll try to keep you safe. That's our goal here. We're going to have some fun, and we're going to keep you safe. But if you're, you know, stout of heart, then you go behind the blast doors and you hang out in our Facebook group where we talk nothing but the latest Star Wars spoilers. It's just a lifestyle choice. It's just up to you. You can do whatever you want. Get freaky. Now, in December, we ended the month with a pile of three episodes on top of one another, leading up to The Last Jedi, our Last Jedi review, and then our review of Secrets of the Empire, the absolutely amazing, you have to do it seriously, VR experience at well, three Disney locations across the globe. But something's been going on in the Star Wars world, really, that needs addressing, and that is the fallout of The Last Jedi. We, you know, having reviewed the film very recently from when we saw it, we'd only had, I don't know, like a day to reflect on what had been going on. And since then, the divisiveness and opinion about The Last Jedi that was reflected in our review between the three of us was reflected full force in the fan world absolutely everywhere. And there were so many discussions that occurred in our Star Wars sort of discussion forum that we run on Facebook, Star Wars Spoilers. There's a lot to cover. There's a lot to discuss about things, both things we've learned about the film after it having come out, and then also just to discuss about what's happened in regards to Star Wars fans, both casual and diehard, and how they've interacted with that film. And that's going to be the discussion point for our next episode in 2 weeks. But for now, it's all blue skies and Han Solo, or so we hope.
I still can't get over the title of this. Couldn't they have just called it? I mean, I would have been happy with Gone in 12 Parsecs. Anything. Solo, a Star Wars story.
My parents just saw Last Jedi today for the first time. And leaving the theater, they came across the Solo poster, which is the first time they had heard of this movie coming out. And my mom called me and actually said, like, you know, mentioned that after she told me how she felt about Last Jedi, she's like, oh, I see they're making a Solo movie. It's like, I'm surprised they're doing a Ben Solo film so soon.
Holy shit.
Oh, and I was just like, oh, my gosh, mom, you just blew my mind. Like, I would never have even like thought that like that was even a possibility. I'm like, no, it's young Han Solo. And she goes, oh. And then she asked me if Harrison Ford was going to be in it, assuming that they would like CG him up.
If only.
Parents are such a good barometer for, like, you know, people who are parents who are disassociated with the fan communities and all that, for really gauging what something along the lines of what the general public consensus of perception is for things. And that is fascinating on so many fronts.
Yeah, and I'd like to think my mom's a pretty unique cookie in some regards. So I don't know if that's what most people would assume, but it is kind of funny when you think about it. I mean, we commented a lot during Rogue One that a lot of people on Instagram during the Instagram teasers were saying in the comments, like, where's Rey? Where's BB-8? Where's this? Where's that? I think people are firmly entrenched in the sequel trilogy universe that some people might think this is, you know, a Ben Solo film until we get a trailer. You'd hope.
Wow.
You'd have to blame Marvel for that, because everything that Marvel releases like is in that same vein, you know, of like, oh, this is the next one. This is the next one.
Yeah, no, it's all basically sequential. Yet, mm-hmm. Oh, but you know what isn't, though? Interestingly, Captain Marvel, I only recently found out, is set in the 90s.
Yep, with a two-eyed, really? Samuel L. Jackson.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited for what that film represents in terms of being weird and shaking up the foundation of everything they've done so far. So maybe the time is now. Everybody get used to it. Things are going to get shaken up. And when you see the word Solo, it doesn't mean what you think. But I do agree, tagging all the way back to the start of this conversation, it's still a terrible fucking name. They should totally have called it something cool. We gave them an entire list of awesome names.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, like, you know, for all the celebration of, like, the pulp stylings that, like, these films had, like, you know, Rogue One had some notes, like Force Awakens, you know, obviously it was full of nostalgia, and Solo kind of has these notes too. Like, they are so scared in their naming. Like, none of the films have come anywhere close to the sort of like pulp names that Lucas was willing to give these films. You know, like The Empire Strikes Back, Attack of the Clones, you know, like these are actually like, you know, of what he was trying to capture stylistically. And I don't know, these names are kind of generic and lame.
Yeah. Han Solo, whether this movie's good or not, deserves better. Much better. He deserves a funky, weird, like Han Solo and the Smuggler's Moon or whatever title.
Right. Well, it deserves an Indiana Jones title.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Kingdom of the Crystal Porg, as previously discussed. So here's the latest on Solo. The film, you know, as we probably all know by this point, was reshot damn near in its entirety, or, you know, according to some accounts anyway. But now, a Reddit user who's offered some confirmed leaks in the past says that there are more reshoots coming, actually, that the Ron Howard shoots have, you know, it wrapped several months ago, and now they're back at it, happening from the end of January, continuing for 3 weeks or so into February, at least. Apparently, these are just pickup shots, but notoriously, the things that were labeled pickup shots for Rogue One, but changed the entire film, those were pickup shots, quote unquote.
Not to mention the sort of, you know, the director turnover. You wonder how much, like, is necessary at this point, right? Like, it's got to be a lot.
Yeah, what one would suspect. And then to tie into the ecosystem of Hollywood, the releases, and how even though there's many separate studios, and even though Disney owns most of them at this point, they all do have a sort of symbiosis and synchronicity. They have to work with each other. And Deadpool was just moved from June 1st, bumped up to May 18th, which at this late date in its promotion cycle is very strange. That's 2 weeks after Infinity War and 1 week before Han Solo. And given that Disney and Fox are now fully in bed together and in all likelihood have been leading up to the public announcement of this merger, it seems likely that Solo is actually going to get pushed from this May 25th date. Now, they wanted to meet it.
You know, I mean, every indication seems that way, but where Solo is now, it's still Memorial Day. It's still, like, you know, traditionally the second biggest weekend of the summer. I mean, we know that's not true anymore. Like, these late April, first week of May releases have kind of, like, become a holiday unto themselves now. But, like, you know, July 4th and Memorial Day were always, like, the two biggest summer movie weekends for a long time. And Solo currently has that. It's so unlikely that you leave it. If you leave Memorial Day, somebody's going to take that spot. You know, somebody that's not Deadpool.
Right. All logic would dictate that when they change directors, they would have moved this due date. But they're like, no, we're going to do it. And I don't know, folks. This whole situation is super weird. And the Deadpool move, I mean, why on earth would they do that? I can't even fathom why they would do that.
I don't either. I mean, people love to box office theorize. You know, does Deadpool get good word of mouth after one weekend? And so it serves as good counter programming to Solo. So, like, you can't get tickets to Solo first weekend. So you just go see, you know, Deadpool because it's rated R and there's no kids there. It's a weird move. Because, you know, they're not together yet, Fox and Disney, but they're certainly talking to each other, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, to tag back to Captain Marvel, this is one of the things that we haven't talked really about any of this Marvel stuff on State of the Empire, but in the same breath where I learned about Captain Marvel taking place in the 90s, because I wasn't really following the development of the film much at all, I also found out the villains are the Skrulls, who are under the license for Fantastic Four, who were over in the Fox camp of things that Marvel couldn't touch with the cinematic universe. And the Skrulls' involvement in that plot line were announced way before this merger became public, which to me suggested that it was happening for a long time beforehand.
Very interesting.
And so here we are. Like, I got to figure they're fully in cahoots, and I just feel like I'm scraping the mashed potato pile saying this is important. This means something.
It must. I mean... You don't move Deadpool there without some consideration for what it does to Solo, whether that helps it, whether it hurts it, and then they have to move it. Or a lot of people have said that, you know, a move would signal a, you know, an indication of Disney's confidence in the movie, which I don't necessarily buy, because the release date is all based on how much money they perceive they're going to make, not on the quality of the film. I mean, there's plenty of bad movies that make a ton of money, and there's great films that make nothing. But the release date is simply dependent upon how much money they expect it to make. And, you know, maybe they don't see Solo breaking the bank like the other two films did. And so they might move it off of Memorial Day. Who knows? But it is very key weekend to, like, hang on to if they think the movie's worth people paying money for.
I think we got to remember that both films are catering to two very different audiences. Deadpool's almost certainly going to be rated R. And Han Solo, I can't imagine being... I mean, it's got to be PG, maybe PG-13, but it's at least aiming for PG-13, if not, you know, lower. So
yeah, and it could have a lot more to do with Infinity War than it does I mean, maybe they have some, although I don't know why they couldn't just wait till June 1st, but like maybe they added some great like meta jokes about the Fox Disney merger to Deadpool, and they want it like right there to sort of like, I don't know, maybe Deadpool was aimed at kind of making fun of the whole Marvel machine, you know? I mean, it's so self-aware, like it might be great coming off of like, you know, in Infinity War's third week.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Just for fun, I wanted to look up what also was released around the same time as the first Deadpool, and 3 days before Deadpool came out, Hail Caesar came out.
The first Deadpool was like a Valentine's weekend movie, I think.
It was,
right?
Yeah.
And but also coming out at the same time as Deadpool was Zootopia.
That was so, a good, you know, man. I loved all three of those movies.
I mean, just because two movies are being released at the same time, it's not like there's a finite amount of money that's going to go around. If they're both good, they're both going to, you know, do good.
Unfortunately, Hail Caesar did not do good. So if you want to see a great film with Alden Ehrenreich, a.k.a. Han Solo, please wait no longer. See Hail Caesar. It is a gem. Now, we have a tradition here at State of the Empire of every time we do a report about something that inevitably, when we're waiting around for some really big piece of news, inevitably it happens immediately after we put out an episode, or if we're really unfortunate, right before. And we haven't seen the Solo trailer yet. It was actually rumored it was going to come out this past week, and it didn't happen. So it's got to happen soon. Matt, you were thinking maybe Super Bowl?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a high profile time to debut trailers. A lot of times it's the second trailer for a movie. But, Solo is a very unique thing because, you know, Marvel doesn't mind, you know, like we saw Black Panther trailers before Thor Ragnarok came out, you know, because, yes, they're the same series, but they're so loosely affiliated with each other. And I would argue that Star Wars is sort of the same way as far as the anthology films. It's not like they're revealing story about the sequel trilogies. You know, like if the Star Wars galaxy is this giant galaxy and you're telling a movie that takes place like 40 to 50 years before, you know, Last Jedi, you know, you can show us something before Last Jedi comes out. But they insisted on waiting. And I mean, think about it this way. If this was Last Jedi and we were this far away from the movie coming out, we would have already had the toy releases for Last Jedi by this point. And we don't know anything about the Han Solo toys. There's no announced tie-ins as far as like literature or media. Like, it's kind of crazy when you think about it. We have nothing.
Well, officially we have nothing. Unofficially, we've got some stuff. We do have a piece of promotional art that was leaked, and at first Disney kind of like refuted it weirdly, even though it was very clearly official. And then, in very short notice, that same promotional art showed up on the corner packaging of a ton of leaked Lego photos.
It's always the Legos first. I always think that's pretty interesting. Always Legos.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. So we've got a whole list of things. We'll link to where you can see these photos on Imgur. It's some neat stuff and sort of points to a lot of confirmation for pieces of the narrative of Solo that we'd piece together from shots, behind-the-scenes shots from the original filming of the movie and some leaked things that were said. First and foremost, the redesign of the Millennium Falcon.
It's cool. I mean, they filled in, like, I believe that's a Macquarie, like, concept from early illustrations of the Falcon. They filled in the gap in the front.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if they're going to go back and say that the Millennium Falcon in Revenge of the Sith was not the Millennium Falcon. I think as of now, it's canon that it was the Millennium Falcon, but now it might just be a YT, you know, 1300, 1600, I don't even remember, freighter.
I think it's
1300. Which is probably the smartest thing to do, let's be honest. Like, let's not try to shoehorn the Falcon on Coruscant, like, around Order 66. But
yeah, I mean, where exactly did that show up officially? Just, like, in a dictionary or something, or what?
You see it in Revenge of the Sith. You see it.
But it could be any freighter like that. It just happens to be dirty,
right,
like the Falcon.
Right, and I think just during the ramp-up of Revenge of the Sith and then the material out, and then also there was an Expanded Universe novel called Millennium Falcon that was, like, stories about the different owners of the Falcons over the years, and it, like, you know, ended with Lando and Han having separate stories, and you know, it featured the story of one of the owners having it on Coruscant around the time the Empire started. So, you know, they canonized it in the old expanded universe for, you know, what that was. But obviously that's Legends now. But I think since then, it's still been listed that the Falcon was, like, its first appearance canonically was in Revenge of the Sith, chronologically.
Right.
And I don't think anybody would be upset if they just said, no, it's just a YT-1300. Like, it's really what we should be hoping for.
Right, this ship looks new. It's got a clean paint job. It's snazzy.
It's like they made something retro, even stylish, more stylishly retro.
Yeah.
It's
cool.
It's like a happy medium between prequel and classic eras.
And yet also with something we recognize, which is really unusual. The Lego playset that we have is specifically Kessel Run Millennium Falcon. And because it's a whole playset, it comes with a ton of mini figurines that offers some character context for when this is happening. And then also the background of the box has these details in it. It's like the Kessel Run is taking place in some kind of lightning nebula with TIE fighters shooting at them. So, Matt, what exactly is the Kessel Run in prior expanded universe content?
If I remember this correctly, it was a smuggling route that took them very close to a cluster of black holes called the Maw in the Kessel system. As it turned out, the Imperials had like a facility on the inside of these, like in a safe space in between all these black hole clusters, which is where they were actually like building like other prototype weapons. Like they kind of worked on the Death Star back there. They built the Sun Crusher, things like that. But like, that's not related to the Kessel Run other than the fact that the black holes are present. Yeah. It was just, it's a smuggling route really. And you know, it's very dangerous and hard to run because of those black holes.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know what to make of the background of this box. It's all space electricity basically. And maybe there's a mountain in the like lower left-hand corner. Maybe.
That's interesting. I didn't notice that before.
But I'm not really sure. With these kind of grainy web photos, that could be anything. But I guess while that's up in the air, and you know, who knows what the Kessel Run is at this point, we can talk about the figures that come with the Millennium Falcon, which could be quite telling, depending. We have Kira, who appears to be Emilia Clarke's character, Han Solo, Chewbacca, Lando Calrissian, someone named Quay Tolsite, Kessel Operations Droid, and DDBD. So the Kessel Operations Droid looks like a creepy-looking red protocol droid, and DDBD is kind of like an astromech droid, but he has stubby walking legs underneath him. Looks like maybe an older model of some kind.
I think he is, the conjecture is that he is some sort of hybrid, like piece-together droid made up of a astromech's top and a gonk droid's bottom.
Those did look like chubby little gonk legs, yeah.
Which I think is adorable and could be very, very cute on screen.
Quay Tolsite is easily the most interesting person in this list here. Because he's a very unusual-looking alien with some kind of a helmet. And Matt, you identified it as most likely a pike, which is a species I was not familiar with.
Yeah, they've been in Clone Wars, and I think they made an appearance in the Darth Maul comic, the Marvel one that came out a few months ago. They run a criminal empire that I believe are like the main guys in the current canon. I think they're the biggest producers of spice in the universe. So
that would
tie in with the Kessel Run. They mostly have appeared on Clone Wars, so that would be great to see a transition of, you know, the Saw Gerrera thing was nice, but it's easy to take like, not easy, but you know, it's one thing to take a human character, like a character from the Clone Wars universe, and then flesh them out further. But it's great to see that they're willing to bring creations of Dave Filoni and his team and put it into the live action universe.
Yeah, it makes the expanded universe really valid and feels like it's working and a rewarding transmedia experience, not fluff. Yeah. And that's kind of what Star Wars is contending against right now, is like, with the films still being the Bible for what really does or doesn't mean anything or stay canon and so on, it's nice to see things that don't get thrown away and that do expand the world for people who are bothering to invest the time and money into continuing to love Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean, Saw Gerrera, I loved him and the portrayal of him in Rogue One. I appreciate bringing Saw Gerrera into the live-action universe, but they didn't do enough to tell me that that was actually the character from Clone Wars. Like, he didn't talk about his time fighting in the Clone Wars. He didn't talk about his sister, Steela. Nothing about that character in Rogue One even like subtly indicated that he had a larger story that's already been told in this universe. Like, he certainly has a story, but not something that the fans, without knowing his name, could have identified him as, like, oh, that's the guy from Clone Wars. The only reason we knew that is because of the marketing going into the film. But doing things like bringing alien races from Clone Wars and stuff like that, that's subtle ways of making the universe bigger that, like, feels more concrete and effective, I guess.
Another interesting thing about what we've got from these Lego figures is that one of the aspects of the Solo story that we knew so far confirms that it does in many ways mirror facets of the older aspects of the Han Solo origin story that were already established in the prior canon. Certainly going to change a bunch of things, but we've got Corellia, we have the Kessel Run, and we have Han Solo running with Tobias Beckett, a criminal mentor dude, who's notably not present during the Kessel Run, for whatever that means. But let's look at what we've got for Corellia, because we have some things that are just straight up, hey, this is on Corellia, you're totally going to see Corellia. There's Han Solo's speeder, which is a package that comes with Han Solo, Kira, and a Corellian hound, which is something new, I think. And then there's also Moloch's speeder, which comes with this character Moloch, a guy named Rebolt, and two Corellian hounds. And they both, on their backgrounds of the Lego boxes, you see what looks like a sort of like grim shipping yard kind of vibe. So I guess that's what Corellia looks like. And these are definitely the things that we saw being shot in the behind-the-scenes photos taken in front of the power station in the UK. And then on New Year's, and we'll link to this, Ron Howard posted a interior shot of the like cabin and steering wheel of Solo's speeder. So the Corellian hounds, they're like tiny white buffalo dogs. And they're chasing the speeders. They're like running with the speeders. I don't know if you know how much you can invest in a Lego box. After all, as a follow-up to our Lego speculation, that sand speeder never showed up in The Last Jedi and still hasn't shown up anywhere else, so...
Yeah, I think we just have to... The sand speeder is just somebody's idea of a joke, I guess. It just got out there.
A weird joke.
Yeah. Yeah, Corellia has been portrayed in a bunch of different ways over the years. I think it's just generally kind of a future industrial earthy planet. Like, it has green areas, it has jungles, but it also definitely has like Star Wars cities. So, you know, I could see it being portrayed in this movie in a bunch of different ways. The industrial park where they were filming was, you know, or the industrial plant, very interesting. I wonder if we're going to get kind of like a Blade Runner-y vibe type thing. Like, it's very, you know, dystopian. Dystopian might not be the right word, but very dirty urban future.
Yeah, I mean,
do you mean to say that Corellia is more than one biome?
At least it did. Like, I mean, it had mountains. It had, you know, like, it had everything. So I do hope that, like, you know, we don't need, you know, we don't need a resistance soldier on Corellia, you know, telling us what the terrain is by licking his fingers. I'm hoping we don't need him.
The character Moloch, he might be a pike, maybe. He looks more like a Quarian from Mass Effect.
Yeah, I have no idea what he is. I'm a little disappointed they call him speeders. I was hoping, like, because Han was a swoop racer at one point in the old EU, and I thought it'd be cool if they were like swoop bikes. Like, I know we've had swoop bikes in the film, so we had them in Attack of the Clones and I think in Clone Wars, but it'd be cool to see Han riding a swoop bike instead of a speeder.
Yeah, that was how Dengar's face got messed up, was an accident with the swoop bike race.
Yep, and Han fucked up his face.
And is Dengar going to be our Dr. Everson? Maybe. At the very least, that would be rewarding instead of insulting.
I think he's messed up in the Clone Wars cartoon. So I think he's already messed up. I think. I'm trying to remember back, and I don't recall if he's all screwed up yet.
That's a good point. I, having not watched Clone Wars, I forgot that I at one point learned that he was in it.
Everybody was in Clone Wars. even young Chewie, once again, making another appearance where he doesn't belong.
Moloch's speeder looks like an 8-track being loaded into a player, and then it's like a 1-seater thing, and it also has kind of this laser Gatling gun built into the hood. It's an interesting, rugged-looking design, and as Han is speeding away from some green blaster bolts on the front of that thing, we can assume that he's outrunning this Moloch guy, who I guess is a bad dude. Especially because he's rolling with a dude named Rebolt, who appears to just straight up be a human slaver of some kind. He's got a whip. And then there's the Imperial Battle Pack, which also features another vehicle that we saw in the behind-the-scenes shoots at the power station, which is this severe-looking, what I would call a swoop, an Imperial Battle Speeder of some kind. It's not the speeders from Endor. It's something much more armored.
It looks like something you'd see in Rebels.
Yeah, it totally does. With this set is a female domed black Imperial officer, like the dudes, like I forget what they're called, like any of the dudes have the sort of like half dome spaceballs looking helmet.
And they call them spaceball troopers.
Yeah, spaceball troopers. And then there's a mustachioed Imperial officer, and then two brand new stormtrooper types, the range troopers, because we can't have a Star Wars film now without reintroducing a new class of trooper armor.
We get at least two a movie, right? Like Force Awakens, we got just the First Order Stormtrooper and then the Fire Trooper.
We also got a new Snow Trooper, underutilized with the deleted scene.
Right. But... yeah, Rogue One had the Shore Trooper and the Tank Driver.
Death Troopers in Rogue One, and then... huh. There is something. I know there's something. Because, like, I feel it.
Oh, the Executioners.
Yes.
And it looks like we had two new ones this film.
Yeah, yeah. With the Imperial TIE Fighter, we get what's called a Mimban Stormtrooper. And I assume that's a planet?
Not only is that a planet, Cap, but...
school me, Matt. What's happening here?
Mimban is where, in the very first piece of Expanded Universe material, at least novel-wise, I think the Marvel comic run had started by that point. It was 1978, and it was Splinter of the Mind's Eye by Alan Dean Foster, and featured Luke and Leia crashing on the planet Mimban, and getting into some very sexually charged situations where Luke kind of spied on Leia changing.
Oh, great. I love how often that fucking happens to Leia, just like fucking Prince Caesar and Shadows of the Empire. Ugh. Mm-hmm.
And they end up getting into conflict with Vader because on the planet of Mimban is a temple of the Kyber. But of course, in this, it was the Kyber crystal, like not a Kyber crystal. The Kyber crystal. Like, I think it was like K-A-I-B-U-R-R. It might have been spelled that way by that point. And it was a crystal that could magnify the power of the Force. That was the rumors. And sure enough, Luke managed to get a hold of it and fight off Vader because he had this crystal. And Vader falls down a chasm. Like, it kind of, the temple like splits open like Last Crusade, and Vader falls into it. And, they escape, and it's not a very good book. I don't think Alan Dean Foster is a very good writer. Sorry, Alan, if you're listening. But one of my favorite things that ever happened in the Expanded Universe happens in this book, which is, like I said, this was written in 78. It might have been 79, but I think it was 78. And when they're leaving the temple, by the way, Luke doesn't bring the Kyber with him. I think he loses it along the way or something like that. But anyway.
How convenient.
They left 3PO and R2 to watch the temple in case Vader and the stormtroopers showed up. And they were not warned when Vader showed up. So when they get outside the temple at the end, they find both droids deactivated. And it's like the second to last page of the book. They flip the switch back on 3PO. And 3PO's like, "I'm sorry, Master Luke. You know, it was Darth Vader. Somehow he knew the access codes." And I never thought about it. And then all of a sudden, Phantom Menace comes out. And Anakin created 3PO, and I know it's coincidence, but it's still one of my favorite things to explain how somehow Vader knew the access code to shut 3PO off.
So good.
It's almost like I had an aneurysm in the theater.
Like young little Matt having an aneurysm.
I knew going in the Phantom Menace that Anakin created 3PO, but it wasn't until I was watching it that I was just like, oh my God, Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Like, he knew the access codes, because it always bothered me.
And that is the power of an expanded universe right there.
Right, that they're retconning Splinter of the Mind's Eye in an official film. But so the Mimban Stormtrooper means we're going to that planet, which, by the way, has been featured in Clone Wars, I believe. I don't think it was Rebels. I'm pretty sure it was Clone Wars. So we have seen the planet in animated form, or I'm sorry, it was mentioned in Clone Wars. But we're going to possibly likely go there, which is freaking amazing. Like, they're pulling a planet from the very first piece of Star Wars book. That's great.
Yeah, cool. And with the inclusion of Tag and Bink, I mean, Solo's going to be full of weird stuff. Hopefully it's a good movie, and I don't like fan service, but in terms of if it actually uses these opportunities to not pull stupid sight gag fan service like Ponda Baba and Dr. Everson, but to actually stitch it together and make it feel, I don't know, just like something as cool as an episode of Rebels, great. Sign me up.
Right.
This Mimban Stormtrooper, basically Phasma. A not shiny Phasma with a black cape covered in dirt. And all the Imperials look rough. They all have like crap all over them from this Mimban set. And it's just a TIE fighter. It's just a regular old TIE fighter that comes with these Han Solo minifigures, as far as I can tell anyway. And then the box shows a kind of misty, swampy looking planet, which is my understanding of what Mimban is like from Splinter of the Mind's Eye and all the art I've ever seen. And then there's a little like launching, like a shooting star, but like launching from the planet in the distance on the box. Most notably, though, this comes with Han Solo and Tobias Beckett, but both of them are wearing Imperial uniforms. Now, I saw a list of all the minifigure stuff for Solo where they were listed as Imperial disguise Han and Beckett, but on the box itself, it does not say that.
Right. And I pray that we do not get another like three Star Wars films in a row where they use Imperial disguises in order to infiltrate a facility. Like, I already get it weekly on Rebels, and I really don't want it to happen again. You know, like Jin and Cassian did it, then Finn and Rose did it. Like, there's got to be a better way to plot these movies. I'm hoping that it's just Han and Beckett are stationed there during their Imperial days. Like, that would be very interesting, just getting to see them actually in Imperial service, like Han's original kind of origin story. Something worth mentioning, Cap, about Mimban also, is apparently they were originally going to use the planet in Rogue One as the setting that they ended up putting Jedha.
Huh.
And then eventually they developed Jedha. So Jedha is obviously was used for its kyber crystal. Like, you know, they kept that aspect of Mimban. I'm curious if this movie involves kyber crystals at all.
At this point, it would seem kind of silly for it to, because it has so much else to deal with. But maybe, I mean, you know, maybe this is more kyber mining for the Death Star.
It could be a throwaway thing. It could be Han and Beckett as Imperial officers on a planet, and they're stationed there because of a kyber mining operation.
Yeah. That wouldn't feel wrong. It would just be another, you know, another thing.
Yeah. I mean, there seems to be a lot of focus on the Death Star construction in the era between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope. Yeah. Like, everything expanded material seems to focus on it. That's the, you know, the Empire's only thing. Like, Thrawn heavily mentions it, Rebels, you know, obviously Rogue One. Like, it, it you know, there's got to be something else they were up to. It's 18 years.
Yeah.
Kyber crystals are okay, but I just don't want to see another lightsaber.
Well, what would be interesting, though, Doug, is you're right. Keep the lightsabers out of it, but maybe Han's frustrated that they're there getting these things that he thinks is based on a bunch of force mumbo jumbo. You know, like it's a chance for us to see character be skeptical and then carry that on. I like you, am worried that like the character in A New Hope might not make sense because he's been through things. It's like I can dispel like Indiana Jones being a skeptic in every single film, despite what he's seen in the previous ones. But I don't think something so connective like Star Wars should go that route. You know, like I hope Han the character still makes sense when this movie's over.
That would be ideal.
Yeah.
There's two other Lego things worth mentioning. There's a buildable range trooper, and the range trooper we can only assume is some kind of like, you know, like range targeting thing. Otherwise, we don't really have much of a clue about what that actually means. And then there's a Solo buildable figure. These are like action figures but made out of Legos, where it looks like, I don't know, I can't tell, is this the Lego or is this the figure, and is it even something we're gonna see in the movie? It looks like he's wearing brown armor on a dark, stormy planet, and this photo is way lower res than all the other photos we've got. So make of that what you will. The only other piece of Solo news we have is that Donald Glover was recently interviewed about the reshoots and about how production might changed when Ron Howard came on board. And this is what he had to say. He said, it didn't change. He did a good job of coming in and didn't want us to change what we were doing at all. He wanted us to be comfortable with our vision. And he said that, at least from the prior reshoots, he actually didn't do a ton of them. So maybe someday we'll get the story of what exactly this crazy, mixed up production entailed. But we'll see. We really don't have long to wait to find out what the hell this thing is, what it looks like.
We're 4.5 months away. Like, when are we going to get something?
It's so weird. It's so, so weird. I mean, with your mom being confused about it being a Ben Solo film, I mean, gosh, I really, really hope that this film doesn't, you know, if it's good or even it's bad, I hope that they don't screw up marketing this movie, because there's not a lot of time. This is a really weird, weird thing they're pulling here. Before we carry on with some additional Star Wars news, we got to give shout outs to the awesome people who make this show possible. Now, we might have moved over to Consequence of Sound, but as of now, this show is still co-produced by the Nerdy Show Network, and everything that the Nerdy Show Network does is entirely listener supported. We are going to be moving to a new platform that is ad-based in the near future. That is both Nerdy Show and the Consequence Podcast Network. But that doesn't diminish the fact that those things, that's uncertain money, that's added benefits. But when it comes down to like day-to-day things and assurances that we'll be able to continue to do this kind of content, well, if it's being made by Nerdy Show, that means that that we rely on you. Like, the situation could change for State of the Empire at some point. But for now, well, State of the Empire and all of our past and future bonus perks and everything else are available to people who support us via Patreon at patreon.com/nerdyshow. Like I said, maybe that dynamic will change somehow in the future. If it does, we'll let you know. But right now, same deal as the rest of the Nerdy Show Network. Another way you can help support us, and this goes for anything, anytime, anywhen, anywhere, is if you like this show, then you can rate and review us. You can do it on iTunes, which is still the go-to place for podcast reviews, or you could do Podchaser, which is a platform built for podcast discovery, where you can not only rate and review series, like, you know, State of the Empire on the whole, but also specific episodes. Like, if you dig just this episode, you can give us a review for this episode, or just hop on there and give us a 5-star rating. But some kind souls did give us reviews on iTunes recently, including one by, oh boy, HDHDXHUSSH, in a review entitled Witty Review Title. They say, simply a fun and informative podcast about Star Wars. P.S. R2-D2 is far better than BB-8. Shots fired. But I agree.
I do too. Although I do really like BB-90. or this review by Chim Chim's Revenge. Oh, I like that. Revenge of the Chims. The best Star Wars podcast.
Woo!
This is by far my favorite Star Wars podcast. These folks know their stuff and cover all facets of Star Wars fandom. Fun, informative, critical, and even spoilerific in the designated Behind the Blast Doors segment of the show. This is one not to be missed. Give it a try.
And then we have a review that, wow. Well, Doug, I'll let you read this sucker.
Yeah, this one actually means a lot. So this is called Straight Shooters by Bo Franklin. I owe you guys an apology. I had thought some of their past episodes had been too nitpicky about Disney's handling of Star Wars. Too negative, too cynical. I can see, after viewing The Last Jedi, I should have considered their concerns about things more. They're not positive for the sake of being positive, and they're not negative because they're snobs. They're honest and tell you what they think.
Bo, thank you so much for writing in. Previously, they'd posted a low review to iTunes, which they've since rescinded, and we discussed it because we were concerned. It was about the nature of, well, basically negativity about Star Wars, and we wanted to make a point of saying, like, look, we realize that sometimes we can be very critical, but it's only because we really do, like, care about this, and we're doing our best to assess everything that we're intaking in terms of all these news and rumors and everything. So thank you so much for writing in again, contacting us on Twitter. It really meant a lot. Now, there's plenty of other ways to reach out to us, including Facebook, which most people don't do much, but someone contacted us recently via the Nerdy Show Network Facebook, Michael, who said, "Hey, I've been listening to your Star Wars podcast for close to 3 years. You guys are great. I was hoping to get the names of some good Vader books to read," which that's a
good
great
Vader
question.
Books.
Yeah.
I would have to say, if you want to go back to the old expanded universe, like, if you don't mind that things are non-canonical now, but I still think they certainly, like, I guess, donate their ideas to the new universe and Vader. The Purge comic series was really good, very fun. Just the Jedi that survived Order 66, what they're trying to, like, how they plan to deal with Vader, and then how Vader plans to deal with them and the Emperor. And then as far as books, Revenge of the Sith and Dark Lord, The Rise of Darth Vader end up making, like, the books end up making, like, a really good duology about
so
the sort of, like,
Revenge
the fall
of the Sith,
and further fall.
The novelization of the movie.
Yes. Yes. And I know people kind of groan when you hear novelization. I promise you that novelization is amongst the greatest pieces of expanded universe literature ever written. It is so good and so only partially motivated by the film, and I like the film, but it's purely, like, Anakin perspective for the most part, and he has these crazy dreams about a Cryat dragon coming after him throughout the entire book, and they skip the entire Battle of Kashyyyk because the author just thought that was a useless addition to the movie, and, like, it's really amazingly well done and is by far the best, like, prequel era novel, and there's some really, really good ones, but that is the best.
And then that's followed up with an unrelated novel that just happens to take place immediately afterwards.
Well, they form a loose trilogy, but the first one is not Vader related. There's Labyrinth of Evil, which is the Jedi kind of, it's a mystery novel, them piecing all together the clues from Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones to piece together who the Sith Lord is. And then just before they can, Revenge of the Sith starts. So that one's not so much a Vader book. It definitely kind of feeds into the Revenge of the Sith novelization, but loosely. They were released as a trilogy at one point, like if you can still find it somewhere, that might be a good option. But the three books end up being a very loose trilogy that is probably better than the prequels altogether. But that Revenge of the Sith novelization, at the very least, is just the finest piece of prequel work. And then Dark Lord is a very good follow-up by James Luceno about Vader's first, like, 6 months.
And to the point of Vader's first 6 months in the new canon, I cannot recommend Charles Soule's Darth Vader comics enough. The Kieran Gillen ones are good, But these ones that are just Vader that have been coming out recently, Volume 1 is currently available. Volume 2 is being collected. I think the next volume comes out in April, but it's a monthly series currently. They're fantastic. Yeah. Doug, do you have any input on Vader books?
You kind of stole my recommendation for the Vader comic. But you know what? Since you took that and I'm on the spot, I'll say, even though it doesn't have Vader in it, just get the Lando comic. It's great. The Lando miniseries is fantastic.
Yeah, get that while you're at it. Charles Soule's been doing a really good job, I think, overall so far.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Poe comic ranges from good to awesome.
Yeah.
And then everything else is solid. I mean, and down to downright amazing. So, yeah, he's been doing wonderful work. That guy's cool as hell. One last thing before we get back to business. At Consequence of Sound, we made a little video documentary about the Mos Eisley Cantina and how the appearance in A New Hope had a very strange effect on pop culture. It's a cool short video. I co-wrote it and did the narration for it, and we'll link to where you can check it out on this episode's page. But back to cool Star Wars stuff, theme park things. So Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is the name of the theme park experience at Disney World. It opens in, well, Disney World and Disneyland in 2019. And there was a presentation held at Hollywood Studios on December 16th where an interesting, weird little thing was teased out. There's going to be a toy shop that's this boutique experience that sort of gives a feel for what exactly Disney's trying to do with this experience. And so far, everything we've heard about Galaxy's Edge sounds too good to be true. And this is no different. There's this guy, Chris Beatty, who is the executive creative director at Walt Disney Imagineering, said, "We wanted the environment to have an exotic nature to it, so we turned to the marketplaces of Istanbul and Morocco. You'll find these little stalls that all have backstories. We have a toy maker in this market, and it happens to be a female Toydarian," which is Watto from Episode 1. That's his race. And I don't know that we've ever seen a female Toydarian in anything.
Maybe Clone Wars. Maybe, though. They go to Toydaria a few times. There's an arc that takes place there, but I don't remember any female Toydarians.
Plot twist, Watto was a female Toydarian.
That'd be great.
He goes on to say, like items found in a Moroccan bazaar, carved details and hand stitching will take the place of mass-produced replicas in clamshell packaging, the personality of a foreign culture brought home through a work of art that guests can actually bring home. The beauty of the shop is in its artistry. It'll be exclusive to Galaxy's Edge. It's all about story. When you build the story, it gives the place life. So you're going to go to this stall in this alien world that's going to sell boutique handmade stuff made by, I don't know, maybe actually indigenous people in other countries. Who the fuck knows? And it's going to be sold to you by presumably an animatronic or hologram. How's that going to work? I have no fucking clue. But there is a very low quality illustration on a Orlando Business Journal article that we'll link to on this episode's page. I don't think they can pull this off. Like, I just mean long term. Like, there's, right? Am I being pessimistic here?
I don't know. Like, I don't know. Just because I don't know how they can do it doesn't mean that they can't do it. But just here's the truth. People are jerks. And people who are in large crowds and they paid a lot of money to get into Disney, they can feel very entitled and they all want the singular experience. Everybody who goes to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter wants to go into Ollivander's wand shop. They want to get the wand chosen for them. They want to be the one who gets to do that one experience, but not everybody can do it. Everyone's going to want to go to this toy store. Everyone's going to want to talk to the Toydarian. Everyone's going to want to have this thing, but you just can't do it. So I think people are going to ruin it. Disney might set it up and they'll realize, oh my gosh, we didn't realize this many people wanted to talk to the animatronic Toydarian. And it's going to have to be scaled back and it's going to be lines of people. You could check out your toy in one line with a human who's wearing the Disney name tag, or you can wait 2 hours to check out, you know, whatever toy you want to buy with the animatronic or hologram. And I don't know. I think Disney has definitely some great ideas, and they probably have a plan of how they want to do it. But I think the reality of the situation is going to be way different, because people are just going to hit too hard and be too entitled and too demanding.
And I'm still worried they're going to start making Star Wars experiences a premium at the park. I'm worried Star Wars Land is going to be a separate admission on top of your ticket, which is the only way they're going to be able to control crowds. I don't know what it's like at Orlando. Like, I guess Disney Hollywood isn't the most well-visited park there.
Certainly. Especially not now. It's 100% under construction. There's nothing there.
Yeah, but Disneyland, I can't believe it's in Disneyland. I know there's no room to build at California Adventure anymore, but like, that park is so crowded. It is so tiny compared to Magic Kingdom. I don't know where everyone's going to go. It's everything is constantly, like, even during the week off summer, it's still like 90-minute lines. You can't move anywhere. It's awful. It's an awful experience, quite frankly. And I just don't know why Star Wars Land had to end up there. Like, why not in the other park? Because California Adventure, there's plenty of room to walk around because there's nothing to do.
Yeah, you could even tie to, you know, Star Wars into the Skywalker Ranch experience. That's a very Californian thing. I don't know. Or just, you know, hey, realize that California Adventure was maybe not the best theming for a theme park and sounds a little bit Six Flags for a Disney presentation, and just make that Star Wars Land.
Yeah, and they're already kind of abandoning the idea of California Adventure being a California park. Like, there's all kinds of rumors that they're about to do a Marvel Land, that sort of thing, which is why the Guardians of the Galaxy Tower is there now, that, you know, mission, whatever they call it, breakout. So I wouldn't be surprised, like, for them to abandon the California identity, but I don't get why they didn't put Star Wars Land there. It makes no sense to me.
Here's another thing that doesn't make an abundance of sense. Disney filed a patent last week that clearly pertains to lightsabers and potentially for use in theme parks. They filed a patent back in 2016 that would let park guests operate lightsabers via a projection system, which is not something that's come to pass so far. But this new one, which we'll link to pictures of, shows systems and methods for augmenting an appearance of a hilt to simulate a bladed weapon. And there's a graphic that kind of shows this thing that is clearly a lightsaber. And it's unclear what is exactly going on, even from the language of the patent. But the blade might be augmented reality. And then there's a seemingly related patent that they also filed, which describes an environment where a user with a faux lightsaber interacts with a drone flying through the air or operated with hidden rods to appear as if it is flying through the air. Which with drones that would follow a signal in the saber to interact with you. So that's like, imagine that seems very specifically to be like the training orb from right. A New Hope, you know, following where you are. But this is an actual physical object that's doing that, which is weird. And then the same patent, that same thing, also describes a vehicle controlled by onboard sensors and tilting propellers that can climb walls using something like magnets, suction, or static electricity.
It's really cool.
Yeah, but that's that's all we got.
At this point, it's so hard to believe what information is out there about this place, because I haven't seen something like this that is that effective in real life. That I just, and I know Disney is not real life. It's magical and it's, you know, whatever. But oh my gosh, that is some lofty, lofty plans for Star Wars and the Star Wars experience. And we haven't even, like, the hotel is going to be basically the same thing.
Yeah. Star Wars Galaxy's Edge Part 2, for real. Like,
yeah.
Which is definitely a separately ticketed experience to enhance your Star Wars Land time. So yeah. There could be even three thresholds of price to experience this thing. If not, there's definitely two, but there could be three. But let's move on to comics, which will be the last thing we do throughout the whole show, actually. Forces of Destiny. It's the online short webisode thing featuring all female characters from around the Star Wars universe. It's on YouTube for free to watch, and the actual shorts themselves have ranged from terrible to actually kind of awesome, but mostly not great, mostly middling. The comics are, well, so far there's two of them out, and they are also very much a mixed bag. There's the first one out was Leia, which was amazing, and the second one out was Rey, which unfortunately was not. We'll get into why in just a moment. But if you haven't checked these out yet, do hit up a comic store and pick up Leia for sure. This takes place during Hoth, and it's gorgeous. It's really well put together and is a fun story that builds on, you know, the Rebels' time in Hoth. It's written by Elsa Chartier and Pierre Collinet, who hopefully I'm saying their names right. And it's also also drawn by Elsa. Hera's in it. Hera is on Hoth doing stuff. The story just, I won't get into the story. It's a simple tale, but it's fun. It's worth reading. I loved the hell out of it. Then the Rey issue, you know, I would love to have high hopes for Rey, but once again, the character finds herself completely and utterly underserviced. It's written by Jodie Houser, who is great, but so far her work on Star Wars has been kind of weird. She did the Marvel adaptation of Rogue One, which violated continuity for the other things produced for Rogue One. So no one, it was built to expand the film, but no one knows how much of it's even real. In terms of the canon of Rogue One, if the canon of Rogue One even actually means anything.
Well, it's more, it's just Jin's personal canon. I mean, there's some, man, it's some bad stuff. I mean, I would side on ignoring flashbacks and weird allusions in the Rogue One comic and just stick with everything else from the young adult books and the Rogue One novel. It's probably a better place.
Well, there is a Rogue One. There's another Rogue One adaptation that's out from IDW right now. Matt, you've read it?
It's pretty standard fare. I enjoyed the interpretations of the characters and the art. And even though IDW's books skew younger, at least the stuff that they do for Star Wars, certainly, I will say I felt that it was still quite brutal, like Rogue One is. And I appreciated that despite the art, despite the targeted market, they didn't hold anything back in interpreting this film.
Yeah, the cover of the book's a bit deceptive because it's just a kind of lousy photo trace of one of the posters for Rogue One, but the interior art is a really great, somewhat cartoony, but like compellingly cartoony style.
Uh-huh. Yep, absolutely.
But here's what's broken about this Rey book. It's an adaptation of a previously released Forces of Destiny webisode. This is the thing that we were shown in animation at Star Wars Celebration this past year and has already been online for 6 months.
And Disney Lucasfilm Press adapted it in a young adult adaptation of Forces of Destiny. Like they adapted all the episodes in books already. So this would be the third time that the story's been told.
And the Forces of Destiny comics were solicited as being original stories, exclusive to the comics. And this is a fine telling of it, and it's well rendered. The pacing's great in terms of like writing. I don't know, there's no other writer credits here, so maybe Jodie Houser actually wrote the original short, perhaps. But even still, the fact that it's this comic makes no sense and just sort of shows the lack of commitment to, like, they don't want to do anything with Rey. Rey is dangerous. Rey has so much of an uncertain future in terms of what their plans are for her future or her past that they won't, like, this might have even been a last minute gig. I don't know. You know, I don't know. But it seems such a shame for someone who lives the life of a scavenger, who could have stories, you know, that take place almost anywhere in the huge gulf of time that she was doing nothing on Jakku. Hanging out with Constable Zuvio, for example, they're not telling these stories, and I don't know why. It seems suspicious, really.
Yeah, I don't get it. It's the same. Yeah, I don't know why they have to tell that worm story how many times. It's very strange.
It's super peculiar. But all that said, this is where we get off before the Blast Wars. Just a little comic book tidbit behind the Blast Wars. If you don't care about what's happening in Star Wars comics, want to hear some cool stuff, follow us behind the Blast Wars this time. We're not going to talk about anything else, I swear. But if you're leaving us now, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of State of the Empire. And we'll see you in a couple weeks with our episode recounting all the fallout from The Last Jedi. And following that, We're going to be talking about Star Wars Rebels leading up to the final 7 episodes when the show comes back for season 4 and the series finale.
Open the blast doors! Open the blast doors!
All right, so I talked up the Darth Vader comic, and it has been great. Let's talk about this most recent arc, The Dying Light, where we see the Jedi librarian, Jocasta Nu, and her Jedi school that she's set up, and some amazing shit with Vader. I'm the only one who's read this so far, but I've been sending things to Matt. So I didn't know Jocasta Nu, but she was actually in as a live action character in Attack of the Clones.
Yep.
She's an old lady. She's a librarian. She's not a particularly great fighter. She's a diehard archivist, and she survived Order 66, it turns out. And what we learn here is that she's been recording Jedi teachings, hiding them in some kind of like secret location on a remote planet that's not named, behind a waterfall. But there's some stuff she's got to do. She has to return back to Coruscant to try to take care of some unfinished business. And so she leaves her facility with this one guy with some specific instructions, goes off, and but she's on the short list of people that Vader needs to take care of. But in this case, Palpatine wants her alive. And what we learn is he wants her alive because she could give up the names and locations of Force-sensitive children. In the beginning of this arc, we see Vader interacting with the Grand Inquisitor from the first season of Star Wars Rebels. We see Vader personally training the rest of the Inquisitors, including one of whom I believe is from the Mace Windu comic. Now, that series ended with that character, the blind Jedi who turns his back on the Order. It doesn't at any point say that he went on to become an Inquisitor, but he is basically kicked out of the Order and like tried for his crimes and all that. So, prime candidate. They've as much said it without saying it. And what ends up this huge, amazing conflict in the Jedi Archives where with Jocasta Nu versus the Grand Inquisitor and versus Vader and doing what she can with her limited powers to fight back. She realizes that Vader is Anakin because she has a secret archive where the good stuff is hidden, and a droid identifies his like biometrics and says, "Ah, Anakin Skywalker," which he does not like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a character from Clone Wars who I wasn't familiar with, Commander Fox.
Yeah, he wasn't in a lot of Clone Wars, but he showed up. Actually, at the very beginning and at the very end, pretty much. That's it.
Vader kills him for some insubordination. Vader is a new force here because he's like fresh off the block. Like, the Imperials don't know what to make of him. When they see him from a distance with a lightsaber, they think he's a Jedi and start shooting at him. Of course, they all get killed. We see some really weird old lightsaber designs, including this kind of like swashbuckler style hilt, and then Vader ends up with this whole list of children because Jocasta has a discussion with him where she's like, "So the reason Palpatine wants me alive, do you know why? Have you even bothered to ask yourself why? It's because he wanted this list, and he didn't think that, you know, he knew I could give you the information, but he didn't know I'd have a list," because she actually has like basically it's on a disc that kind of looks like the Comtech readers from the Phantom Menace toy line, actually, the little microchips that had voice. It looks exactly like those things.
That's funny.
And so Vader ends up, he subdues her. He takes this list. He's got it. And some Ourobesh flashes up in his eyes, and you can see his heads up display. Weirdly, this book's been out for a week now. I haven't seen anybody translate this online yet, so I guess I'm gonna have to do it myself. Maybe I'll flash it up. I'm a very busy person. Maybe I'll flash it up on Star Wars Spoilers and see if anyone can help me out with that. It's probably just a bunch of Easter eggs, but maybe it says like Elora Danon, because she was a Force-sensitive baby in an episode of Rebels. Granted,
that would be really cool.
This is way too early for that because that happened like 3 years in. But anyway, so Jocasta's like, that's why Palpatine wanted me alive. So what? So do you know why? Because he wants these kids, because he's going to make more of you, dummy. He's going to make more Vaders. So Vader kills her and everyone and just reports to Palpatine, yeah, she died, unfortunately. It's too bad. And I didn't get any information. But then we get an epilogue that flashes forward a undetermined amount of time where we see that the guy that Jocasta left behind to take care of the data she left for a school, he seals the waterfall, and then the rocks get moved away by none other than a slightly older than Return of the Jedi-looking Luke Skywalker. So he used her materials, no doubt, to take care of his Jedi school, such as it is.
It's interesting that they would flash forward like that.
Right? Also, fun little thing. Charles Soule recently tweeted that he pitched Disney a storyline for Poe Dameron where he says that he swung for the fences and really didn't think they'd go for it, and they totally went for it. And I don't know what that is, but the Poe story has already been pretty crazy, including some really good stuff with Lor San Tekka. And I don't know, but hopefully it'll make up for, you know, what I view as Poe's severe mistreatment in The Last Jedi.
Yeah. Have you gotten around to Storms of Crait, Cap?
I have not yet. I've got a short pile of things I haven't touched yet.
Yeah, that Storms of Crait was a fun little canon-violating, or maybe not canon-violating, but canon-abusing mess. The Leia Princess of Alderaan book established that Bail Organa had set up a rebel enclave on Crait, and Leia found out about it, and Leia went, and Leia visited it, and Leia saw it, and whatnot. And in Storms of Crait, post-Yavin, Leia and Luke go to check out Crait, as if Leia's never been there before, to see if it should be used as a rebel base. And they get there and they're immediately sold out to the Imperials before they can even establish a base, and they abandon Crait. So now, whereas the skimmers had looked like the remnants of an old rebel base in Last Jedi, now it turns out those were just mining equipment left over from a base that they wanted to use but never ended up using. So they never actually had a base there. It wasn't an abandoned rebel base. It was a mining complex that they just opted not to use. I'm very confused what they were trying to do there.
Yeah, which because points that says a bunch of weird things about not these expanded universe things, but The Last Jedi and what that was written as and when it was written as that, and how on earth did they get these two things released that were so wildly disparate from one another?
And the release dates were far away from each other too. You had plenty of time to fix Storms of Crait. Princess of Alderaan came out in September.
And Princess of Alderaan doesn't do anything to contradict the film. Nope. So why would these two things be different? And in the comic book, all you really have, if something goes wrong in a comic book, generally you might have to change a page, you can rearrange some word balloons, you can swap out a panel or two. It's a much easier fix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, they are sold out to what is it? Scar Squadron? What are they calling the squadron of elite? Yeah. They're sold out to Scar Squadron like within an hour of being on Crait. And it's just Luke, Leia, Han, and Wedge. And they fight Scar Squadron and they decide that they can't stay on Crait because of these, you know, the Empire knowing where they are essentially, and they leave. So they never had a rebel base there.
Now, I need to go back and scrutinize the visual dictionary for The Last Jedi, but the whole page dedicated to the Crait facility, I believe, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, someone please correct me here, I think it was a weird hybridization of that. I think it was like it was a rebel mining base, and I mean it definitely mentioned the Scar Squadron thing, so whatever is in the visual dictionary is a weird hybridization, and one of these two things, and I'm guessing it's going to be this comic book, is going to end up as a legend.
Yeah.
But so dumb that this is the film tie-in book here, and it's wrong, like, immediately.
Like, it was weird. They're brought to Crait. It's not like they showed up to Crait in the comic and they're like, well, let's go check out the base that my dad set up. It was like Leia had never been there. They didn't say that, but they, you know, Leia certainly was acting that way.
And they're like, I have a contact there. He's going to show us what he can give us in the, as far as like places to hang out. And they met this like mining, like essentially he owned mining equipment and, you know, the mining complex on Crate. And Leia was like, I don't really trust them, but like, I'm going to give him a chance. You know, I give everybody a chance. And he's like, check out what I have, which is clearly the base from Last Jedi. And then all of a sudden the Empire comes into system and they're like, you sold us out. And he's like, yeah, I did. I sold you out. And then they leave.
That's fucking dumb. I mean, well was the book any good aside from it violating or?
It's very hard to follow. Like, you'll have panels like Luke gets into a fight with the guy that uses the lightsaber in Scar Squadron, the commanding officer. And Luke finally gets the upper hand by using some like native life on Crate that they hadn't really shown in the movie. Some things that live underneath the soil. And of course, they're talking during the fight and, you know, Scar Squadron saying that, like, you guys have no hope, you know, no chance, da da da. And then when Luke gets the upper hand because of these creatures, he's like, gives a speech very reminiscent of his speech on Crate in Last Jedi. And he's standing over him holding his lightsaber. And then it cuts back to Han and Leia's portion of the ongoing fight. And then Luke shows up and he just goes, Scar Squadron got away. That was it.
Well, that's weird, man. That's really weird.
Like, no explanation. Well, I don't know what's going on.
Maybe avoid that like $5 or $6 that one shot's going to cost you.
Yeah, I just, with an endless cycle of films, and this is, you know, you take the good with the bad. I get a Star Wars movie every year. Like, that's awesome. I'm never going to complain about that. But one of the sacrifices, I think, is some sort of semblance of a expanded universe that can hold itself on its own because they're so subservient. And these things are being like constantly edited. And that's why all the Rogue One stuff got pushed back to April, because Rogue One itself needed to be, you know, tinkered with heavily. So I don't think they'll ever do anything big again that can kind of like stand on its own. Like, there'll be some good issues here and there, but like big stories aren't really a thing anymore, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they're never going to shape the universe ever again. Not in any real way, which is just a damn shame. And it is really a damn shame, because the story group has the power to say, hey, we want to tell a great Han Solo story. Let's say as an example that we can't do because it really should be Harrison. So let's tell it here. But even those stories in that era tend to be, for the most part, highly abbreviated and not really the stuff that you tell your friends about. There's been some great stuff, most of it written by Charles Soule. And Dr. Aphra stands alone as a great thing that's so separate from the rest of what's going on with the characters from the films that it gets to have its own life.
Yeah.
But heaven help you if you want to deal with the actual main characters, because you're not going to get to do anything of merit.
Uh-huh.
I guess unless it's Darth Vader.
Yeah.
But that's where we're going to call it this week. And we'll see you in 2 weeks with an all new episode of State of the Empire. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Doug.
Bye, I'm Matt.
State of the Empire is a production of the Consequence Podcast Network. Check out our expanding roster of music, film, and television podcast programming at consequenceofsound.net. This show is recorded and produced in Orlando, Florida at Nerdy Show Studios, home of the Nerdy Show Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. Discover more at nerdyshow.com. Special thanks to our Boffin pals at the Star Wars Spoilers Facebook group, the Nerdy Show Network Patreon backers, and Will Roe Hood, hero of the rebellion and keeper of the most delicious data core this side of Delphon. Keep on running, Wilro.